702 and Cape Talk.
Talking Sex.
And we've got Dr. Shingai Mutambirwa with us this hour. He's, of course, head of Department of Urology at Dr. George Mukhari Academic Hospital. Lovely seeing you.
Lovely seeing you as well. Like a nice beard you got there.
Oh, I thank you. Long. And you smell nice.
Oh, thank you.
You always do, but particularly today.
Ah, I think, I won't. It's a Friday, as you said.
You know, he wears many different hats, this love doctor here. So I'm going to embarrass him by going off topic first before we talk health. We just had a really fun conversation. And I want to know what you reality star think, whether money is an important trait in terms of a prospective partner or not, or whether it's all about love.
I think it's
because Mary J. Blige is very clear
that it's.
I'm not dating any broke niggas. I've had enough of paying for them.
I think I'll backtrack and just use a quote from one of my favorite authors. I think Thomson Robbins, who said that when you look at money, money is not material. It's actually a spiritual thing, because the only purpose of a guru is to knock you off the path. And once you knock off, once you stay on the path, then the guru says everything's cool. And the best thing to knock you off the path is money. So money, if you start taking it too seriously, and the guru's knocking you off the path. And if you take it too less seriously, you're also knocked off the path.
So how does the bank feel that you're servicing the bond with spirituality?
Ah, no, the banks know me very well. I just say that I'm your safe business friend.
Okay, so as always, when we have Shingai on the show, we will allow you to ask a diversity of questions related to men's health in general. 011-883-0702. And he's going to do his best to obviously help you out. And where he can't, he'll direct you to different experts that will be able to do so. If you're in Cape Town, 021-446-0567. But we're going to start while waiting for your calls. But please feel free to interrupt us on any topic related to men's sexuality and men's health. We're going to start talking about a really interesting gene editing issue. And I was saying to my producers this morning, Doctor, that this is a really interesting one, because for a long time now we've grappled not just with the interesting scientific debates going on in terms of the advances and what can and can't be done, but related to that, also some really, really fascinating ethical questions which ethicists reasonably disagree.
Oh, yes. I think it's a really exciting topic. Everything's really moving at high speed when it comes to this now. And I know a lot of dour and dowdy people out there tell you that the sex is only for reproduction. And although there's many animals that do have sex for pleasure as well, and they say that, no, it's only just to encourage you to reproduce. The whole reproductive system is such an amazing thing, because it's really improves the diversity and the hardiness of all creatures. And I think what was quite exciting is that a lot of my patients, when they come in and they say, okay, they've got issues having babies, this, that, and the other, what we call infertility. It's about 15% of the population has it, and the sexually active population has it. And it's we often don't know what the cause is, and we often look at other things. We look under the microscope at the sperm, at the eggs of the couple, and try to see what's going on. But often we can't find what's going on. And then often when we are doing assisted reproductive techniques, they often say, is it possible for us to select whether it's going to be a boy or a girl? And I think this is, it is possible, actually. It can be done, and there are ethical issues about that as well. But the point is that the going further on, it's now getting to the point where if you have something like this is Lou Gehrig's disease, or one of these conditions that are genetically transferred, but they're essentially fatal, and you know you're going to be passing it on to half of your children, in if it's what we call autosomal dominant, then they sometimes ask, there have been many questions, can we edit these genes, the gene that causes it, out of my baby, my little embryo, so that it will never suffer from these conditions. And the ethics of it are just too widespread. I'll put it simply that they're essentially what why there was such a hurrah about this young, geneticist in China, Zhuang Ku, was that there's been all scientists involved in gene editing have come to the conclusion that we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know most importantly, we don't know the safety, because if you change one gene, it might affect another one, which will cause you other problems. And so, but what he did is that he unilaterally decided to offer a couple who the husband was HIV positive, the wife wasn't, and he changed one of the genes in the self of the embryo so that it would be resistant to HIV. This one is really not too difficult to break down morally. It's actually, there's lots of other things which can prevent HIV transmission. It doesn't usually happen to babies from the father anyways. Yes. So the whole, his reasoning is really quite long, will be difficult, and he's actually disappeared. I don't know whether that's a Chinese permanent disappearance or a partial disappearance. But I think going forward, we're all going to we're going to see more and more about what's going on here. And I think just so the listeners understand, well, it's really not that difficult. I'll put it in the case of a bacteria, because bacteria, everyone thinks bacteria are nasty. They're actually very good for your body in many ways. But they also have predators as well, such as different what we call viruses like plasmids and prions, which can insert their DNA into the bacteria's DNA. And to extrapolate, you could do it to humans as well. But that's just to make it simple. The bacteria, therefore, and know that there are lots of these plasmids and prions and things floating around. In fact, if you look at the data, there are about 10 to the 30 more of these prions and things than all other bacteria, animals ever in the world. All right. So they're everywhere. But the thing is that they're so diverse that the bodies, the bacteria has to be able to defend itself rapidly. So what it does, what it's been done, and what humans have also done, almost all prokaryotes, as we call it, which are the animals and things, is that we have substituted the DNA of this virus into our DNA code as well, so that when if a virus comes which is similar, we'll immediately recognize it using what we call CRISPR, which is what this Zhuangku used, to pick up if there's a virus, and then it's a form of what we call adaptive immunity. So the body can then fight it very quickly and the bacteria won't die. Same thing in humans. We also have the same thing. And we have lots of these things, literally millions, maybe billions of them. And how it's operating is that when we see this CRISPR area, there's something called Cas9, which is an enzyme, which then splits it and then can start producing, change that gene area. And we're just using this system, which is already in the body, to gene regulate. But the problem is, of course, as I said, we don't know exactly what the safety is. But I think going forward, especially at the moment, it's only being used in the in what we call in vivo in humans, in conditions where there's absolutely no other treatments that we can have. These are some of these neurodegenerative diseases and stuff to assess it. But the morality and the issues surrounding it are really quite complex. And I think it started off with a lot of my patients just saying, no, I want a baby girl rather than baby boy. I think going down the line, we might even end up with designer babies where...
That's quite fascinating. I was always under the impression that the bigger ethical debate within the medical fraternity was in relation to something that's not really fundamentally about medicine per se. And it had to do, I thought, predominantly with social beliefs around you just need to live with the biological lottery and not play God. But what you are saying is that potentially there's a more rational set of worries that are ethical worries, even though they're also scientific worries, such as we don't actually yet have levels of gene editing precision with which to know what the levels of risks are. That's quite interesting, because I thought this was already a very advanced field technologically.
So technologically, it's been around for almost a decade, if not more. But the thing is, more and more is coming out. But I think the social aspect is super important as well. But the point, when you consider that every human has got 46 genes. Well, not every. Some have fewer. But the point is, but that's in genetic things. But the thing is, 46. If you're male, you're 46XY. If you're female, you're 46XX. Each of those has billions and billions and billions of these genes going on inside them. Each of them is producing something, and the complexity of it, even when we divide, when we reproduce, the fact that we split ourselves into half so that half of the DNA is there, and then we get another half from somebody else, and then we can get evolution. And we know that if you do believe in evolution, that the body has changed, our brain sizes have changed. A lot of people think we're the pinnacle of evolution, but we're actually still evolving. We're far from anywhere near a pinnacle. We've still got so many things. So I think that social aspect is important. But I think regardless of that, we know that we're going to have to accepted that there's something going on. It's like we know that Copernicus's theory was long gone, but the point is that some people still believe that, but that's fine by them. Each person must decide what they feel.
14 minutes after 11 o'clock, if you've just tuned in, we are talking sex, and you are indeed hearing the familiar voice of Dr. Shingai Mutambira, who's head of Department of Urology at Dr. George Mukhari Academic Hospital. It is an open line. In general, we put questions to him in relation to men's health and men's sexual health specifically. If you've got any questions, do give us a call. Something that's worrying you, he's going to do his best to try and help you out. 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg. That's where you can reach us. And if you are in Cape Town, on 021-446-0567.
702 and Cape Talk.
Talking sex.
So I had a question for you, and I know you've answered this before, but particularly in the last week, this has been in the news. Can you explain why testosterone matters? Like, what does it actually do in the body? And in what ways can it enhance all sorts of performances in a human being? Obviously, you know why I'm asking the question, because of Kester, but it may be a wonderful learning moment to just understand what testosterone does, including what a reduction in it would do.
Okay. I'll weigh in on what I think of this whole debate at the end, but let me just explain. Basically, a testosterone is a hormone, and hormones, is for the purpose of the listeners, they're just things which can move around in the body, influencing things. And they're literally hundreds, thousands of these hormones in the body, and they're all of them doing, there's some that are more prominent than others, there's some that are just in the cell, some are just communicating with their next door neighbor. But testosterone is one of the big guns, and it's not just for men, it's also for females as well. It's what we call an anabolic steroid, which means it increases body mass, basically. It increases so cell size, muscle strength, and that sort of thing. And both men and women need it. If you're giving me a thumb suck, the average woman you should has about 1/10 the amount of testosterone that a man has. And the testosterone is not produced from the testicle in a female. It's produced from a gland called the adrenal, which is just above the kidneys. Mm-hmm. And it's a slightly different form of testosterone. They're different versions. I won't get into all of them. But the point is, the main one in men is coming from the testicles. It's testosterone. Okay. It's the dihydrate, and then it's usually converted by a enzyme in the cells to something called dihydrotestosterone, which is the really active. It's about 40 times more active than testosterone. But the one that comes from the adrenal in females, dihydroepiandrosterone and androsterone and some other stuff, and can also be converted by this dihydrotestosterone to active testosterone, which then tells the nucleus again, where these DNA people that listen, start producing, because DNA's only real job is to produce amino acids, which become proteins. And it, once it tells that, if you've got the anabolic steroid, it says, pump up the amount, make these muscles bigger, make the voice change. In babies, it tells, if it's a male baby, develop a penis and develop a testicle. Because you know that if a male embryo has no response to testosterone, there's some people who have got what we call testosterone insensitivity, where they don't respond to testosterone, they'll turn out to be female. They'll look like a phenotypic female. So, in the case of Caster, I think what the problem is that, first of all, it's an inborn. She was born like that. She's got we call them now distortions of sexual development, which is really not a great term. We're trying to change it, but it used to be called intersex and all sorts of other weird things. But essentially, she was being born with more than one type of gonad and or other phenotypic genitalia and that sort of thing. She's been brought up as a female. She's comfortable. She's not in any danger. And she's got the fact that she has got a higher level of testosterone. But that's her natural. She's not supplementing it. So I think in the views of many medicals, there are some, we've actually got some chat rooms from the medical, is that the majority of people are saying, listen, if Usain Bolt's testosterone is higher than, I don't mind, I suppose, and he runs better than me, should I suppress that? I think it's a bit of a moot question, and especially as we're going towards the more open thing, where some countries are even saying that, listen, you don't have to classify yourself as male or female. You can be whatever. You can change your genders. The transgender changes, we're doing so many of them more and more, and even in government hospitals now. I think we have to recognize that, provided you're not taking an antiviral advantage which is outside of your body, which I think really this is a silly discussion, to be honest. Just let me get on with it.
Kester aside, in someone who's phenotypically male, like myself, if I were to deliberately find some way to reduce the amount of testosterone in me, how would that affect me physiologically?
Okay, that's a brilliant question in many ways, because I'll give you the prep, because it's actually been studied so well, because the mainstay of treatment for patients with prostate cancer, when it's spread, which is why you should get your prostates checked so you doesn't spread, is to get rid of your testosterone.
Okay.
And the lower it better, the lower it is, the better to prevent the cancer growing. But we know that if we lower the testosterone, there are multiple side effects. There are the sexual ones, obviously, the lack of feeling of sex, because the testosterone doesn't just work on, it's increasing anabolism in the brain. So you feel, because even female sexuality is based more on testosterone than on estrogens. They feel the higher their testosterone, the more likely they're going to feel sexually stimulated. They also, erection problems, because there's multiple reasons why. There's loss of the muscle around the blood vessels. You lose, but there are other physical things such as losing muscle mass, increasing body fat, which then increases your risk of heart disease, diabetes, hypertension. We know that it can also increase the risk of some other conditions in the body. For example, the way you think, cognition, the aggression, emotions can be changed. So, although it's very effective and we use it a lot, in patients with prostate cancer particularly, a lot of oncologists will tell you that the androgen deprivation is often worse than the chemotherapy for some people. So I think the main thing for us as guys is, first of all, you try to maintain your normal testosterone level, which means that you should be exercising, eating normal diet, not smoking, and not getting stressed. Those are the ones that you have to do. And the only natural way of raising your own testosterone is exercise, to be honest. Second of all, there is what we call like a U curve, where if you've got very low testosterone, bad for your health. But if you also have very high testosterone, it's also bad for your health, because it does other things. It gives you acne, makes your testicles get smaller, gives you problems with erections for paradoxically.
Yeah, you go bald as well.
You can go bald as well, yeah. So the point is that you
I'm going bald, so that should excite people.
You look tough. Yeah, it's just your natural inborn testosterone you show off. So the point is that you have to be, if you're good, again, it's about exogenous testosterone from outside the body. And it can be necessary for some guys, because we do know that there's a manopause where the man starts getting low testosterone. And a lot of people think it's just naturally because of aging and stuff. But there are other reasons why it can happen as well. And if you do have symptomatic low testosterone, and it's not, we do supplement it.
Sure.
And the supplementation is very effective. And there are lots of different ways of doing that.
Peter, good morning to you. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, you guys. Thanks a lot. A tremendous show. Just a quick one here. I'm 60 years old. My oil pressure seems to be normal for me, but my quantity of my oil is not very good. How can I boost that? Do I need to boost that with a testosterone, or how should I do that?
Okay, that's it's a long question, but I'll try to address it in a short way, okay? Most of what a guy, I think what you're saying is your ejaculate is not as much as it used to be, not so. Okay, well, I'm sure he's good. I think that's what he's talking about, his oil pressure or the way.
Peter, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh yeah, Peter. So you're saying that essentially that your ejaculate is actually not as much, and it's not as strong coming out, is it?
That's correct. Oh, okay. Sorry, I put it in mechanics terms,
no.
But I'm a mechanic.
I'm also a mechanic. Don't you know, we're plumbers as urologists. Yeah. That's what they call us.
Your one's better than mine.
I don't think so. Anyways, I think the simple answer here, Peter, is that most of what a guy ejaculates is coming, is not sperm. Less than 1% is sperm. And so and most of it's coming from something called the prostate, which we've discussed a bit. It's thinning around the pipe for passing urine. And about 30% of your ejaculate comes from there. And then about another 70% comes from something called the seminal vesicle, which is just behind it. And we know that after the age of about 40, the prostate starts getting bigger. It can block and grow into the pipe for passing urine. It can also become cancers in some patients and stuff like that. And when you're having orgasm, it's a complex process. But for the purposes of listeners, it's what we call emission and then the physical ejaculation. Emission means that the semen comes out, the sperm come out into the back part, into the area of the prostate, and then the ejaculation of muscles around the prostate in the pelvic area, which squeeze and push it out and give you that pleasurable sensation. Now, both of them can be affected as we get older. The emission is commonly related to what we call a specific type of nerves called sympathetic nerves. And we know that's also one of the causes of problems with blood pressure and stuff like that. So if the sympathetic nerve is not working so well, for whatever reason, it could cause it. But I think in your case, it sounds like you're still having orgasm. Sounds like you're producing it. The most likely thing is that your prostate is starting to get a bit bigger. It might be blocking up a little bit. It might be not producing so much. But I think unless you're having pain or difficulty, don't get too stressed about it. Because the point is, even it's not just about age, even in younger guys or in whatever, it depends. The semen, because most of what's coming out is not sperm, it's dependent on what you're eating, your general health, various other things like that. So if you are really, really concerned about the volume, it's better, you can go and see your GP or urologist. Sometimes when we put you on specific medications for prostate enlargement, they can increase the ejaculation and stuff. But I think the short answer, to really go back to the beginning, is that is really, if you haven't got any other problems and you've had your prostate checked for prostate cancer and stuff, I just relax. Don't worry too much about how much is coming out, and unless your partner has a particular issue about it.
Gotta love medical terminology, emission.
Well, it was a mechanical term. He was looking
at ignition. So that comes after ignition.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you need the ignition for sure. That's what although we do get wet dreams, and the ignition often is not even your conscious ignition. You need to have them to actually get rid of some of the proteins there. That's the medical way of looking at it. Wet dreams are good for you.
The doctor says. Peter.
Hi, Prof. Hello, how are you?
Hi. Extremely well. Thank you, Peter. What question have you got?
So I did a vasectomy a couple of years ago, my partner wants a baby. Is it possible to conceive through artificial insemination or in vitro fertilization and all that?
Yeah, that's what you're saying. Basically, you had a vasectomy, which basically, for listeners who don't know, the testicles produce the sperm, as I said, 1% of what you're ejaculating. They come out through a tube called the epididymis, which is coiled, and then they go through a long straight tube, which runs all the way behind you towards your back, and then comes forward to your prostate. And a very effective method of contraception is for us to do a small procedure where we just tie off the two tubes so that the sperm can no longer travel. Basically, the highway is closed. And the sperm are still being produced in your testicle. But what they're doing is just like with the wet dreams where you have to get rid of things. Our body will eat them up and kill them with our own immune system, because they're now loitering around and stuff. But those are the ones which are being released out of the testicle. So your testicle is still working fine. It's really quite cool and very happy. So if you do want to have a baby, we know that when you do have a vasectomy, you've got about a 95-99% chance it's going to be clear. You should have had a semen analysis, because medical legally, if you don't have that, you'll have a problem if somebody comes and says you've got a baby with them. But we want to consider it permanent, right? And there are some things in the market for your purposes and for other guys, is that we might be trying to get some reversible ones. But if you do want to have babies after you've had a vasectomy, there are lots of options, okay? But broadly speaking, one is to reopen the highway, which is a vasovagalostomy or vasoepididymoscopy. There are lots of things, but essentially it's a surgical thing where you have to have a good center. There are lots of good guys in the country who do it, but you need to have some microscopic skills, and you need to be able to have a good idea about what you're doing with the procedure. So you'd have to go to a specific center. Medical aids won't pay for that. They'll pay for vasectomies, but not for reversals. It probably is, you're looking in a ballpark figure, maybe around 80,000 rands, maybe less, depending on where you go. It's got about an 80% chance it will be successful, but not everybody. It's 80%. And it really, at any age, you can do it after even 20 years, it still works for most people.
Okay.
But the thing is that but the other option is for us to just collect sperm, either with an ultrasound or something, or just a needle. It's not painful. And we just suck out some of the sperm that are sitting around your testicles, still waiting and wondering, why aren't we going down this highway? And then use those. Because remember, every time a guy ejaculates, it's somewhere between 15 and 115 million sperm are being ejaculated. You only need a couple of those to make a baby in reality. So we can suck it from the testicle, go to the lab, put it under the microscope, inject them into the cells of the ovaries of the eggs of your, or the ova of your partner, and then develop them. The main issue with that is that we'd usually try to fertilize at least 4 or 5 of these ova, and so you're more likely to have multiple pregnancies. And there is some, also some people have some ethical issues about that as well, because theoretically there's a slightly increased risk of some congenital abnormalities, but it's so tiny I wouldn't get stressed about that. But the other thing is also the cost. And the cost, again, if you're doing that, is probably hovering in the same amount as doing a vasovasostomy, maybe 60, 70, 80,000 rands. But so if my advice, if you're really, really keen on doing this, then if you want to try to have more than one baby over the future, maybe go for the reattachment, reopening the highway. If you're just looking for one more and you're pretty sure you'll never have another problem, it's probably more effective to do the what we call the ICSI, that injection of the sperm into there, because you have basically around a 40% chance that you're going to fall pregnant, which is far higher than normal intercourse, which is about 4% every time you have sex.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Ashley. I'll definitely be in touch.
No problem.
Thank you, Peter, and all the best to you. And if you've just joined us, we're talking sex, of course, this hour, and we're in conversation with urologist Dr. Shingai Mutambirwa. If you've got any questions, give us a call. 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg, in Cape Town, 021-446-0567.
702 and Cape Talk.
Talking sex.
Yamochetswe says, gosh, that voice, Eusebius. And then she adds, that voice has activated my testosterone. You?
Bob! Hello!
Hello!
Yes, sir.
Yeah, good day. I'd like to ask Dr. Shingai the P shot. He knows about the P shot, how effective it is, whether it's available in South Africa, where can we get more information, and the sort of price of it.
Sorry, what, the P shot, what is that, the injection into the penis, or?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, basically, when you've got erectile dysfunction, which again, if you do, if every guy has failures, please guys remember, if it's not consistent for more than 3 months, you shouldn't really get too stressed. But the point is that we know as we get older, there are erectile dysfunction problems, and they're very closely related to your general health. If you have erectile dysfunction, you need to be checked for sugar, diabetes, high blood pressure, cholesterol, general health checks, and you must get onto the four things again: low calories, bit of exercise, no smoking, no stress. That's the first line. Now, once you've had you've been checked out and everything's cool, and you do want to have something to increase your erections, because remember, at least 50% of guys over the age of 40 start having problems with erections, and so it's super common. The first line is to give the tablets, which are the what we call PDE5s. What they're doing is just relaxing your own blood vessels when you feel sexually stimulated. So they're not going to give you an erection unless you're sexually stimulated. Super safe. They actually can, some data show they protect you from heart attacks. Good for, they have side effect profile is Mickey Mouse, really. The only things to remember, if you are on the PDE5s, no nitrates, which are those things that people use for angina, heart problems, because it can cause precipitous drops in blood pressure. No, and not if you've had a recent myocardial infarct, recent heart attack, or if you can't walk up two flights of stairs without puffing and panting, CCF. But not because it's particularly dangerous for the patients if you do take those, but the MIs and the patients with CCF, but because if you have an MI, a recent MI, or you've had CCF, you shouldn't be doing any exercise, and sex is a form of exercise, actually a very effective form of exercise. So that's the only reason. But once you're over the MI for a longer period, after 6 weeks, you can get onto the medications that might even protect. Second line treatments. This is because the first line, why are we using them first line? Good evidence. They work. No serious side effects. If you fail that, the next line would be for either getting what we call a vacurect, which is a penile pump, which sucks blood into the penis. It can also be used first line. It's relatively cost effective, and it can be good for most guys, but it doesn't make the whole shaft of the penis hard. It's only the part that's exposed, but it can be used quite effectively. And then the next part would be to either use an injectable, which is basically we inject it with a small needle into the spongy tissues, either one or the other side of the penis, which can then give you an erection. And it's working in a slightly different way. There are lots of different ones, and some people combine different things. The commonest component is alprostadil, which is a prostaglandin. And they're very effective because about 90-95% of patients will get an erection from it, even if they've failed on the PDE5s. But there are a couple of side effects. One is that it is a bit sore for some guys to inject it. Second of all, the most worrying one is that you can have what we call priapism, which is a prolonged painful erection, usually above 6 hours between, well, we say three hours now, because we know the longer you have an erection, the more likely it's going to damage your spongy tissues and you might end up with permanent erectile dysfunction because of that. So that has to be addressed, and you have to be comfortable with the idea that you might be able to, that might happen, and you, and the preventions and that sort of thing for that. Getting it in the country, easy. You can get the PDE5s from your doctor, your GP, need a prescription, worked well, excellent stuff. If you want the injection, you also need a prescription. The prescription is, there's only one on the, let me just put it this way. I know that there's some people who are compounding their own and injecting them, and then they charge somewhere, I don't know, it sounds, from what I gather, it's about 5,000 rands for it. But if you go to your GP, he can probably get you almost exactly the same thing for about 200 rands. So you have to make, balance what you want to do there. The second, the Vacurect, you can get on online through the internet. It's about 1,200 bucks. And the PDE5s, well, just for cost, yeah, there are lots of generics of some of them, but you're probably looking for a pack of four at about maybe 150, 200 rand.
And Bob's your uncle.
There you
Bob.
Go.
Muzi, hello.
Hey, Makeza.
Yeah, Bob.
Makeza, I wanted to compliment Dr. Shingai about his tone. I need 10% of his tone, man. It must be a freelancing DJ.
Thank you.
DJs with powerful voices now of late. It's only Kenny Maestri that is mesmerizing most, both male and female on air.
Oh, goodness. Thank
Otherwise, the others.
Have you got a question, Muzi, besides having FOMO about voices?
Okay. Dr. Shingai.
Yes.
In my early 20s, I once had sex until many rounds that I couldn't count, until my sperm gland was empty, and then the last discharge was, I mean, I had a pool on my spinal cord right down up until I felt the smell of blood in my nostrils.
Mm, okay.
Number two, now lately in my early 30s up to now, I'm a pensioner from old age home. I'm nearing a century. In my early 30s up to now, I'm doing around more than 3 hours, 4 hours or so. So it becomes very stressful for one partner. I'm deciding now I must get 2 to 4 per night.
Okay.
What do you think is the cause of that, Dr. Shingai? Because last year, you mentioned the average of sex to all men about 2 to 3 minutes. Then I was damn shocked.
No, that's...
How old are you, Muzi?
Yes. I'm nearing a century, Dr. Shingai.
Excellent. Well, no, well done, first of all. You've always been taking good health of your, taking good care of your health. And part of it has been the sex. I can tell you that. Because as I said, sex is a form of exercise. Excellent for your heart. You're probably going to live for another 50 years, isn't it? They say the first person to live to 200 is already born.
Yeah.
Maybe it's you. Because you sound like you're in super sharp shape. I'll start with the 3 hour erections. Remember, we did the data for how long a man has intercourse after penetration is based mainly on U.S. data, and we use stop clocks to check it, because we all overestimate many things, including our how big or how even how small our penises are, and how long we last, and how effective we are. And I think if you definitely lots of people can last much longer than 5 minutes, and some people can go on for hours and hours. Some of my registrars claim that this is what their activities are like. Maybe they're on off-label medications. I don't know, but the point is that if you are going on for a long period of time, even if it's up to 3 hours, that's nothing to be too worried about. The issue is that if you start getting pain in the penis, because that indicates that you're going to be having you're getting some lack of oxygen and increased carbon dioxide in the spongy tissues. And that the reason why those injectables often have that, because remember, priapism isn't just from the injectables. You can also have it from other, just without any causes, lots of things. But if you get pain from it, then you should start getting a little bit worried, and then you should get yourself checked out. But otherwise, we know that this is all experimental. We know that if you look under a microscope, we usually use rat or mouse penises. And if the erection lasts that long, we know it starts damaging the tissue and you can have a problem. Now, the youthful part where he had blood in his head and thing. Now, there are 2 points to this. First of all, every time a guy ejaculates, why the ejaculate was going down as he continued for this marathon that he was involved in, comrades of sex, as far as I can see, is that most of what's being ejaculated is not sperm. So what the body does, it's producing the prostate fluids and the seminal vesicle fluids. And if you're having lots of sex, all it does is really just change the amount that it's trying to emit.
Okay.
So less sperm will come out, less semen will come out, and so the volume will go down as the period goes on. But the fact that he was on continuous for with an orgasm is also a medical fallacy, okay? Because not because he didn't do it. I'm sure he did. I know you wouldn't lie to me about that. But the thing is that the only people who can have multiple orgasms, which if you look at Masters and Johnson, is where you get a peak of sexual pleasure and it goes down and then you can start again, are females. Mm-hmm. Females are the only ones who have multiple orgasms. What was happening in your case, physiologically, is that you had a very short, what we call refractory period. Now, when you ejaculate, it releases chemicals, including adrenaline and stuff like that, noradrenaline, sorry, and it causes the blood vessels to squeeze down and stop blood rushing into the penis. That's why even if you get, once you've had orgasm, for most men, most guys, you're not going to be able to maintain the erection because your body's just doing its job. But what happened, but the time to break down these chemicals that are making your penis go flaccid can vary. And the best erections for guys between the ages of 18 and 22, during that period, you might have a refractory period of 5 to 10 seconds. So while you're still inside, you'll still be able to continue. But it's not really technically multiple orgasms. It's multiple erections that with a short refractory period. And if you live, as we get older, a bit of wear and tear, other issues, we know that if you reach 80, and Muzi sounds like he's almost 90, the average, and it doesn't sound like it's you, but the average man around 80 will have a refractory period of about 30 days. And again, it's just part of the natural aging process. But in your case, I think we must include you in a trial and find out exactly what you've got, because I think this might be the new Superman if you're almost 100 and you're still going 3 hours at night.
The lines are going crazy, but unfortunately, we have run out of time. Doctor, thank you so much for always sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure. And I, by the way, I answered every one of those questions correct, guys. Every last one.